Can you describe the Clovis point you found and your reaction to it?
You know, I never found a full Clovis point, and I would really love to, but I was on my way out of the mountains in central Wyoming, and I stopped at a friend's ranch. He had just bought a small ranch at the foot of the mountains out in the sagebrush, and I was walking down a two-track road that went through his place, and there in the dirt was the base of a Clovis point. And it wasn't black obsidian. It was a green stone. It's called oolitic chert. And that was rather odd because oolitic chert is finely speckled. I picked it up, and it took me a while. At first, I thought it was a flake or a scraping tool. And then the more I handled it, the more excited I got because I realized that it was the base of a Clovis point.
And for those of us listeners who don't know what a Clovis point is, can you just describe it?
The Clovis point is from the Clovis culture. And the Clovis culture is approximately 13,000, perhaps 15,000 years old. And it's the first culture in North America. It's rather perplexing because as a culture, it pretty much exploded coast to coast. As soon as they were here, you find Clovis points in Virginia, you find them in southern Canada, you find them everywhere. New Mexico, of course, Clovis, New Mexico, is what the Clovis point is named after. That's where they were first found.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Jack Clinton about his environmental novel, Clovis. We'll set off by covering Gnarly Girls and Jack's personal connection to a woman who went missing while running in Wyoming's Wind River Mountains. Your novel, Clovis, features a young archaeologist named Hannah and her compatriots who are hired by Can-Am Oil Company to assess the impact of an oil line on historical native sites. And on your website, you say that the novel was inspired by the event of finding this Clovis point. Is that accurate?
Right. Yes, it was. And then my wife is an archaeologist. That's where most of the information came from. She was always surveying for this or that. Sometimes she would survey just for a specific oil pad where an oil well was going to go, or a short pipeline or transfer station. Sometimes it would be for a water line or a municipal building. And so she was always surveying, and often she stayed in these archaeology camps, and she was always telling me these fantastic stories about all the itinerant archaeologists that went through these camps and the funny lives they led. And a lot of them were living out of tiny campers on the back of a pickup or just sleeping in a tent night after night, or run to town for a shower and a real meal was a big deal for them. And of course, they were drinking beer at night and sitting around the fire. So that's where a lot of the stories came from.
I can tell your eyes are sparkling as you talk about this, and you really bring these camps to life in the novel. I want to talk about your heroine, Hannah. What is a gnarly girl?
I've been a climber pretty much my whole life. You know, a lot of climbers are women. Women climbers can be really gnarly. Yeah. I mean, they don't think twice about throwing out their bag and sleeping in the dirt, and they can eat top ramen for dinner and get up in the morning and do a 10-pitch route that involves several miles of uphill and downhill walking. And so I guess that would be the definition of a gnarly girl.
It's one of the offhand names that Hannah's called. And I want to bring in another perspective. Wyoming author Allison Hagee writes, "In Hannah, Jack Clinton has created an unconventional heroine for all seasons, a humane and restless seeker who can master every terrain except that of her own heart." So there is a lot of do-si-do relationship swapping that happens in the book. Did you mean this to be reflective or predictive or something else about monogamy and sexuality?
In a lot of the kind of itinerant lifestyles, you run into people that have a mate, but that mate is in another city or in another state. They have these relationships that are long distance. You know, the same is true perhaps for climbers and skiers. It's funny that they seem true or perhaps committed to another person, but not beyond the extent of what they're doing, what they're pursuing in life. Right. And so often the relationship is this very nebulous thing that's kind of on the back burner while they're pursuing what they can actually put their hands on.
Yeah, what's right in front of them, huh?
Mm-hmm.
There are also a couple violent scenes in the book. One which reminded me very directly of the 2012 murder of Sherry Arnold, the woman from Sydney, Montana, who's out running, and two fellas who were looking for work in the Bakken oil field.
Right.
Murdered her. And I was wondering if the book draws from that event, or if not, you know, what were the inspirations or news feeds or landscapes that you drew from?
Yeah, I certainly had that in mind. I'm very familiar with that. And, well, this is a little bit personal, but there was another woman in Wyoming who disappeared under pretty much exactly the same circumstances.
Wow.
And this was simply a better outcome. She was never found. And so this was an alternative outcome to that situation.
Yeah. It's important to write, right? The moments of triumph, because so much of life doesn't go the way we want.
Right. There's so much. And she was an gnarly girl.
She
was a runner. She was a very, very strong person. Yeah, she just went out for a run one day in Wyoming and just disappeared. And no one ever saw her again.
Mm. Is this your way of honoring her then?
Yes, in a way. Also, I didn't want to capitalize on it by any means. It was just this haunting image or scenario that was in the back of my mind, and I couldn't shake it. I was out with the search parties that looked for her, and yeah, it was just a tragic event. It tore our community apart for quite a while. Maybe this is my way of rewriting that scenario.
One of the things you highlight in the book is the misogyny that Hannah faces. Why was that important to you as a, you know, maybe a middle-class white man?
I've always been very aware of what women went through. I was raised by my mother and my grandmother. You know, neither of them were treated very fairly in life. I've just always been very aware of what women go through and how it's really not fair for them. And I'm always thinking, why do you stand for this? Why do you stand for this? And in many situations, they have to stand for it. That's just the way our society is right now. I've just always been really confused by this whole role that women have in our society, and that it should change. And just recently, my daughter went out running and she forgot her mace. She was in a very nice area of Vermont, but there was a man on the trail. Mm-hmm. She immediately just ditched it and spun around and ran the other way. And we were having this conversation. Why can't a woman go do anything that a man can do? Why can't a woman go running in the desert? Why can't she run in the mountains alone, where a man can do that? I've never been very comfortable with that truth.
There's an echo in one of your other characters, Paul,
yeah,
who makes the reflection that he's more comfortable seeing bear tracks when he's in the wilderness, you know, maybe than human tracks, which I know for myself that also is true. I'd much rather run into a wild animal than a human male.
Exactly.
Which is really sad.
It's sad. It's really sad. If I was a woman, I would be one of those grouchy women who's always railing at men, I think, because it's hugely unfair.
Yeah. Well, you've written a character, Hannah, who does that quite beautifully, I think. She's easy to relate to, at least for me. I noticed in the book that there's a lot of moral ambiguity, you know, whether it's in the tension between the oil production and the archaeologists, you know, about sort of man developing the earth, about romanticizing the Clovis Point, because I think there's a way that it's easy to look back 13,000 years and say, oh, those were better times.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, isn't the oil field just the modern version of that? And then the other piece, you know, the moral ambiguity of violence in self-defense. You know, where does that cross the line?
Right. Because she doesn't know if she should even have maced the two guys.
Right, right.
All right. They were just trying to get her to get into the pickup.
Right.
Right. And so I'm kind of a child of the 70s. I was always skiing and climbing. That was always a huge argument, like, what could we do to earn a living and pursue our lifestyle, but be as environmentally friendly as possible? After many circuitous conversations, it came up, well, there's nothing that you could do. Even as a writer, well, look at how much paper I'm using up.
Right.
Or as a school teacher, the reams of paper and the energy and power that we have to use to sustain a massive school building. And it's really difficult. How do we live our lives as environmentally friendly as possible?
Right. The book is called an environmental novel. And there are acute place descriptions, you know, birds and bird calls, and really beautiful portraits of landscape. But I found myself wheeling around in the book, and I didn't know if I was in Montana or Wyoming or the Dakotas or New Mexico or Colorado or Texas even. So was that intentional on your part to make it kind of like the reader might not know where in the West they were? You just knew you were in the West or in the desert or in the mountains?
I wanted to operate in complete fiction. You know, a lot of it is very thinly veiled. Anybody that knows many of the places that I write about will see right through it. But I did. I wanted to operate just in complete fiction and be able to write things, to be able to exaggerate things, to be able to write things precisely if I wanted to. It's just me as a writer, I would just hate to give away all of that information and then perhaps have people disagree with some minute detail that I got wrong. And that's not the only reason. I wanted it to just be pure fiction.
Yeah. What do you love about fiction?
I'm rather a coward about writing about myself. I've never really been comfortable writing about myself. And these people are not me. And although Hannah is an archaeologist, Hannah, in some instances she is, but mostly she is not my wife. I just like the freedom of pure fiction. You're just making it up. You're just telling this story. You know, many times I don't know where the story's going. A lot of times I have a basic idea, such as Hannah almost being accosted in the desert. Beyond that, I have maybe perhaps a structure there from real life, but I just like to operate in pure fiction.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Jack Clinton about his novel, Clovis. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, Jack will address the term, the New West.
The book brings a term to bear called the New West, and I was wondering if you would be willing to read a section that addresses this.
Yeah, certainly. So Hannah is on her way to go visit an old friend of hers who happens to live in a large city. Hannah actually loved the routine of empty roads that led her to Meg. And the day progressed nicely, the shadows growing long across the earth as she reached the interstate. Once on the interstate, all her anticipation for Meg turned to highway anxiety. She feared the traffic and the cultivated land, the condos which sprang from the earth as quickly as corn. She could see its northward progression. Much of the area she had traveled in the past was now unrecognizable to her. The highway was crowded with factory liquidation centers and one-stop travel malls. The western landscape was mottled and twisted, where corn grew and cattle grazed below the skeleton broadcasting towers, and John Deere tractors wove their way between the Flying J Superstation and the Conoco Gas and Go. An obsolete cowhand on a motorcycle pushed a small herd of Herefords from one pasture to another, below a spiderweb of power lines, and a horizon lost in a pall of gas and diesel exhaust. This was the New West, a suburb of ranchettes, sprawling subdivisions and trailer parks, spotted here and there with populations dense enough to be called cities. She had once thought that the West was unique in above this type of sprawling expansion. But it was obvious that this was not the case. This was America, and land was only a commodity, as it would be in Detroit, New York, or Newark. "I have seen the future, and it makes no sense," Hannah said to no one in particular. As she drew closer to the city, she felt that she had made a grave error. She wanted to flee. She didn't want to see the future. She had almost forgotten what she was hiding from. She thought that she must have been out of her mind to think that she wanted to come down here to get away from it all. What comforts and civilities could possibly make up for the ugliness and crush of humanity that awaited her here? She began to panic as the traffic pressed tighter around the far right lane that she had claimed as her own.
What does the New West mean to you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I lived in northern Wyoming quite a bit, and you know, the New West kind of snuck up and surprised me all of a sudden. And, you know, northern Wyoming stayed pretty free of a lot of the sprawl and insanity for quite a while. And my first indication that the New West was coming was I had flown back to visit my mother, and I was going into Manhattan, and on a billboard right there, you know, we are dropping down into Manhattan, and there's this billboard that says, "Visit Jackson Hole." And I saw that, and yeah. I said, "Oh my God, they know about Jackson and Manhattan."
Oh no.
And so that was the first indication. And then it's funny, I stayed kind of isolated in Wyoming for a long time. And then I would start going to Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and I would just see this incredible sprawl that was going on, especially like in New York, in Salt Lake City. And I was just floored by it. You know, I just thought that the West was always going to be the West, but that's not how it turned out.
One of your characters says, "I worry more for the desert than the mountains."
Yeah. You know, and that's true. You know, the mountains have like an intrinsic value. Hunters, fishermen, hikers, people that just want to drive by and see them out of their window. You know, the mountains just have kind of this aesthetic protection. But the desert is much more fragile and much more under siege by mining companies and petroleum companies, and it has no value. You know, but then ironically, the value of the desert is its entirety. You know, animal populations and migration routes and everything through the desert, they need the entire desert for them to exist. And so the desert is a very unique situation.
Another one of the lines that caught my attention, Hannah says, "The earth doesn't lie, does it?"
No.
And I want to know, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. The earth does not lie. You know, we can fool ourselves as long as we want, but the earth does not lie. And you know, you can argue about how old the earth is and, you know, whether or not evolution exists, but all you have to do is look at the stratified layers out in the Wyoming desert, and there's the truth. You know, you could go into the Wyoming desert and very easily find clam shells that are almost, you know, a quarter of a billion or half a billion years old. And a lot of parts of the Wyoming desert are just scattered with these little squid cones, or it almost looks like a bullet. And the whole desert is just scattered with these cones that came from squid from when that was the inland sea. And the earth does not lie.
So what is the story of the Wyoming desert then? What does it mean that there was an inland sea to you?
That is actually completely mind-blowing. And I have two answers to that. Well, I have one. I read a book recently, and I was completely blown away by the Shulub, I believe that's how you pronounce it, the Shulub asteroid or meteor that struck the Gulf of Mexico. And when that happened, it completely rubbed out all life in North America, even down to mussels and snails and sandworms. The only thing that survived was in the shadow of the Sierra and the shadow of the Appalachia. And, you know, the inland sea, it completely started over again. It completely started over again. And, you know, from that inland sea evolved the megafauna that, you know, was in North America when the Clovis culture arrived. And it just tells me how timeless it all is. It's absolutely timeless. It's, you know, and I say in the novel that personally, I can almost not believe that it happened. You know, I could pick these things up and look at them, but personally, I have a hard time believing, right, that it even took place.
Right. Because I live in a mountain town or like mountain culture, the other theme that really stuck out to me was human mastery over things, whether it's mastery over oil extraction or mastery over climbing routes. And I was wondering, you know, how do we reconcile this impulse to master things as humans, whether it's for recreation or industry?
I know. That's funny that you picked up on that, because that is, that sticks with me all the time. And it really bothers me that people, they just have to master everything. Oh, and I think Dean says that in a section of the book.
One of your characters.
Dean, yeah. Says that they would go out there and tear it all up just so that there's nothing left to fight over. And I know that there's many, many people that wouldn't do that. But then there are people that would do that, that just have to control everything. And, you know, and it's like the small indigenous cultures that are left, you know, they just can't be left alone. People just cannot leave that tiny corner of the Amazon alone or that tiny corner of the Kalahari. They have to control it. And that really haunts me and bothers me to no end. And I did put that in the book.
Yeah. And you're a climber yourself. Yeah.
You're right. I am.
I mean, how do you approach these two worlds of...
You know, as far as climbers go, I think that whole conquering thing is largely blown out of proportion. As a climber, I just feel like I'm passing through. And in 95% or perhaps 98% of the routes I do, there's no sign that I was there, and there's no equipment left behind. If things go wrong, sometimes we have to leave some equipment behind to get down. But, you know, as far as conquering, I don't conquer anything. I'm just passing through. I just want to be there and remember it. I mean, I don't even take pictures as a climber. I just go and do it, and you know, it was great, and just move on to the next thing.
What do you love about climbing then?
You know, climbing is... Climbing really saved me in a lot of ways from a lot of things. Well, you know, as a very young child, I was exposed to a lot of nature at a very young age. And then I lived in rather urban areas and suburban areas for a while. And, you know, I just really didn't get it. I just could not wrap my head around it. And, I went to work right after school, and I worked hard, worked 40 hours a week, and, you know, started buying things. But I just didn't understand. And my friends would buy like really good cars and go in debt for them and everything. And I was like, I completely didn't understand where they were coming from. And then I ended up in Wyoming and I just realized that I didn't want all that stuff. I didn't need that stuff. And I wanted to live a different life than that. And climbing took me to a lot of places and it exposed me to a struggle that I could justify and deal with.
I was also thinking about loss in the book. And, I'm aware that we just had in Montana another skier who was taken in an avalanche. Jack, I'm wondering, what can you say about loss and risk as part of humans being in, what we might still be able to call wilderness?
Right. And, that Paul is a very tragic character. I just feel that in life there's people that just get treated so unfairly. They're good people. They work hard. They have, simple dreams and plans, and they just get treated very, very unfairly in life. And also Paul represents a lot of people that I used to know in Jackson. And, I started really doing outdoor stuff there in the perhaps the late 70s, and the equipment was evolving and people really pushing situations, and they were trying to do harder and harder things. And a lot of people died. It was not uncommon for every year to be a death of a companion, somebody that you knew from a bar or a restaurant. And it was a small town then, and there were a lot of losses. Even Jackson Hole Ski Area, which is, a very professionally run ski area, they had 3 deaths in about 30 years of ski patrolmen, and who knew exactly where slides took place. They bombed it, they patrolled it, they controlled it. They did everything they could, but they still lost 3 of their patrolmen there in about 30 years.
So what's your advice to the next generation of gnarly girls?
I would just say go for it. My daughter's 19, and I want her to. I say Hannah wonders if Tim is biting into that fruit of life and having the juice run down her face. And I would say do it. I would say do it when you're younger rather than thinking that you'll do it when you're older.
Jack Clinton lives in Red Lodge, Montana, where he teaches Spanish. He's the recipient of the Nell J. Blanchan Award for Fiction. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.